to tell you guys where I'm coming from here. I like to think about moduli problems. Nowadays, I think more about higher categorical moduli problems than what in algebraic geometry are traditionally thought of as moduli problems. But there's, I think, a sort of uniform theory that everything under this heading fits into. That's what I'd like to talk to you guys about. So let's see where to start. Colloquially speaking, a traditional moduli problem is a functor, a pseudo-functor, actually taking values in groupoids. So you, let's say, you've got a contravariant functor f going from schemes into groupoids. And in nature, these things are usually pseudo-functors, which is to say they only respect composition in schemes up to coherent homotopy, if you will. But they definitely take values in groupoids. There are versions of these notions that take values in cat, although typically they're not geometric. Typically you don't see much geometry happening in these functors themselves. So the geometric applications, and you know, under this heading also include Lurie's work on moduli, sort of infinity one categorial moduli problems. They take values inside of a quasi-category. You know, for example, the quasi-category of groupoids. Now, I say this is sort of colloquially how we think of these things, but they are not how they arise in nature. In nature, these things show up as fibered categories. So you have some category M with a forgetful functor, let's say the schemes. I'm going to put schemes as my sort of generic base category, but that's because I'm an algebraic geometer. Anyway, the point is that this guy is going to sort of consist of a category representing all of the families you want to study. So let's say you want to study curves of genus G, you know, proper smooth curves of genus G, then this would be the category whose objects are families C over a base scheme S, where the morphisms are just commutative squares. Cartesian squares. You want to have pullback diagrams. So this should be a Cartesian square. You should think of this as sort of restricting the family over T to S. So this thing is a category, and it has a natural forgetful functor to schemes. And if you start with a moduli problem that somehow characterizes objects up to isomorphism, then this functor would actually take a nice form. So after Deline and Mumford, Grothendieck, really, there are some nice axioms that tell you when such a thing, in some sense, corresponds to a functor. So it's two or three axioms, depending on how you count. The first axiom says whenever you have an arrow downstairs and an object upstairs, you can lift the arrow upstairs. So this morphism should map to this morphism. And it also says that if you have a triangle downstairs and a lift of part of that triangle, and this part you should now recognize as being a right horn. If you have this part of this triangle, then you can lift it. In fact, you can lift it uniquely. And so this is in Deline and Mumford. This is how a category fibered in groupoids is defined. And so you can prove that fibers over objects and so forth are, well, fibers over objects are going to be groupoids. And but really, more to the point, is you have these kind of restriction functors, which is to say, if you start with a morphism downstairs, and you have an object upstairs, so an object in the fiber over S, you think of this as being in M sub S, then you can think of this as kind of mapping to a pullback of C, mapping to T. But the problem is that this guy is not defined. It's only not well defined. It's only defined up to canonical isomorphism. And so you think of this situation as giving you a spread of options of pullback functors. So given two objects in a morphism, you can produce a pullback functor, but it's really one of a choice. And there's a problem here. This problem that's usually referred to in these circles as clivage. And the problem amounts to how do you produce an actual functor from the opposite of the category of schemes into groupoids, which is strict. So with a free choice, you can make one which is a pseudo-functor, but to choose one which is strict is harder. And in fact, you have to replace M by something larger to get this to work. This is worked out by a student of Hopkins by the name of Sharon Hollander. But I'd like to take a different tack, the tack being that the pseudo situation is the natural situation. And more to the point, this fibered situation is even more natural, that these are how moduli problems arise in nature, and we should think of the geometric objects themselves as taking this form primarily. So that's the situation I'd like to generalize to quasi-categories, and hopefully I'll get through a reasonable description of it. Okay, so already I've broken one of the cardinal rules of category theory talks, which is to have an application in mind. The other cardinal rule I'm about to break is I'm going to prove something. Okay, that's my one joke. Let's see. Yeah, well, there you go. Well, no, first you get insulted by the audience, then the audience insults you back, and then you proceed. Okay. Right. Okay. So, first, I want to talk a little bit about the coherent nerve functor, which Julie talked about. Actually, both Julie and Mike mentioned it. This is as low as it goes, so I guess I'll start. So let's start with C, which is going to be a category. Enriched in Kahn complexes. So this is somehow the maximally strict situation. And I'm going to apply this to a few examples in a minute, but let's just work in this general context for the moment. And I want to define a coherent nerve, some guy I'm going to call N, which will run from SC to quasi-categories. I'm going to spit out a quasi-category given a simplicial category. And okay, this is different notation than Julie. These are the actual categories of the fibrant cofibrant objects in the quasi-category model structure on simplicial sets. Okay, so how am I going to do this? Well, I can write down explicitly a resolution of the ordinals as a way of getting this to happen, well, explicitly. So I'm going to, so let's think a little bit. What do we want the zero simplices? If we have a category C, the zero simplices should be the objects of C. The one simplices, well, they should be the morphisms. So we should think of these as, the zero simplices in HOM from X to Y, so zero. So the zero simplices in the HOM spaces. Yes. Yes. Right. This is just shorthand. Yes. I should call this Roman C. Sorry. Yes. No, okay. I should call this KC, because I really want it to be Kahn-enriched guys. Okay. So the two simplices are where things begin to get a little more interesting. So we're going to have three one simplices, and those correspond to morphisms. So we've got maybe an X naught, an X1, an X2, an F01, an F12, and an F02. And we'd like some sort of homotopy between, amongst these guys. And there's one which immediately presents itself, namely F12, F01, going to F02. So this is to say, sort of Hom from the output. Well, yeah. I'll formalize this in a minute, let's say. But this is the idea, so I sort of want a homotopy from F12, F01 to F02. And I'll do one more example to drive the point home. So if we want a tetrahedron, F01, F12, F23, F02, F13, and F03. Well, so what can we draw? We've got F23, F12, F01. We've got a homotopy from this to F23, F02. We've got a homotopy from this to F13, F01. And then both of these admit homotopies down to F03. So there's an idea of what this homotopy should present itself as, that, which is just that, well, that this should be a square. No, put it that way. So we should have somehow a square mapping into the mapping space from X0 to X3. Yeah, no, it equals, so amongst quasi-category theorists, equals is often a shorthand for a cell. I got this from off-the-topic thinking, so, yeah. I mean, right, if I wanted it to be the equality of two morphisms, I'd probably put it that way, but... anyway. So one way to formalize this is to look at all of the indices that show up at these various corners. So here we've got 0, 1, 2. Here's 0, 2. Down here, we've got 0, 1, 2, 3, 0, 1, 3, 0, 3, and 0, 2, 3. And so there's an easy description of these guys. These are just subsets of, well, the ordinal 2 and the ordinal 3, respectively. Which contain the beginning and the end. So I'm going to define a simplicial set, and what this really is just a particular simplicial resolution of the category bracket n. But I'm just going to write it down. It's an explicit thing. So the maybe I'll put it this way. The R simplices consist of tuples S0 through SR, where the SI are all contained in bracket n, and SI contains both 0 and n. Now, I've done something a little sneaky here. I've gotten rid of the direction, so that's why I was fiddling with this arrow here. There's no, like, if I wanted to put direction here, I would say that these guys are, you know, either increasing or decreasing. But the way I've set it up, we can go in any order around this guy. But if you think about it, that's somehow the right thing. That's the right way to do, certainly the right way to do the right way to produce a category which is equivalent to bracket n. I take that back. Right. So, let me think about this for a second. Yeah. So basically, I want this category, this sort of cube, I want it to be equivalent to a point. I want it to be a contractible category. And so the situation here is just we've got a bunch of objects, and each one has a unique isomorphism between them. So it's a contractible category. It's contractible in the easiest way. So now, I can write down a definition of the nerve. The nerve of C, the R simplices of the nerve of C, will just be tuples, X0 through XR, together with a bunch of maps Fij, I, let's see, 0 less than equal to I, less than equal to J, less than equal to R, where Fij maps from C of bracket ij to the simplicial mapping space from x not, from xi to xj. And then we want these guys to satisfy a certain axiom. We want it to look like this picture. So, well, what happens here? Well, for example, here, whenever we see a, well, let's see. How does this work? Right. So if you look at this this interval here, it's somehow mapping, well, somehow F01 happens on the outside. So we're kind of smashing two of these guys together. We're smashing together the 0-1 interval together with the 0-1 from the with the 1-2-3 interval. And so we can sort of code that up pretty easily. Oh, I'm sorry. That's the closed ordinal interval from I to J. And, you know, it means the obvious thing here. I just want Si to be a subset, and this should contain the minimal and maximal element of that interval. No, I'm not asking. So I instead of doing that, I'm actually putting together the data by a bunch of maps. So there's sort of a whole family of these guys. Increasing will come later when I want to sort of take this guy and produce a left vibration. Left vibration. But for the moment, I don't need that. For the moment, I just want to have cubes which get progressively larger in each of the Hom spaces. Okay. So one thing I can do is just map this straight up to Hom xi xj. Hom xj xk, and then I can compose using the enrichment. On the other hand, I can take a subset here and a subset here and take their union. So that gives me a map to C bracket ik, which I can then map over here. And so the only condition on this tuple is that these diagrams commute for every ij and k. Okay. Right. So this defines for me a simplicial set, a large simplicial set, maybe, if C is large. But there's something I should check. And what I should check is this this theorem of Cordier and Porter. So I should check that N of C is a quasi-category. So now, we should remember what a quasi-category is. If we have, well, right, so we want to take some horn, map it into N of C, and show that we can extend this, well, dot, 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 we can extend it over the M simplex. And this is, well, right. So this is sort of where bookkeeping, at least in the way that I like to think about these things, this is where bookkeeping becomes essential. So we should figure out what it means to have given the data of a horn, of the kth M horn. So here it's an inner horn, so 0 less than k is less than M. So let's see, what are we given? Well, we have the zeros and the M space, because we're omitting the kth space, which is not 0 or m. And if you look at the way this is defined, I didn't tell you what the boundary maps were in this simplicial set, but, well, yeah. By virtue of how it's defined, we basically restrict to those fijs which are relevant to the face we're looking at. So the point is that if we omit 0, what we're left with is everything from 1 to n. And if we omit n, we're left with everything from 0 to n minus 1. So we have all fijs where I is bigger than 0 or j is less than n. And we also have all the xi's. This gives us a lot of stuff to work with already. And so the only thing we have to produce is F0M. F0M. How are we going to do that? Well, yeah, right. So what are we given of F0M? That's where these compatibilities come in. So, and, well, the k-spaces. So, let's see, the lth space. Well, the lth space is going to give us every tuple of subsets, like so, where none of the SIs contain L. So, I guess tuples. Where none of the SIs contain L. And this compatibility, yeah, I'm sorry, this is for L not equal to K. And the compatibility gives us all faces, sorry, all of these tuples, all of these simplices of C bracket M, where some J appears. So the J is what allows us to compose it. It's what forces it by data we had before. So somehow the 0J M compatibility gives us all tuples where SI contains J for all I. So now we just want to negate both of these conditions and see what we get. Well, if we negate both conditions, we get all tuples S0 through SR. Remember, these are R simplices in C bracket M. We get all tuples like this so that the union of the SI should contain M minus K. This is the opposite of the first condition. So everything which is not K should come in at least one SI. And moreover, the intersection of the SI should be just 0 and M. So this compatibility forces that second part. And so we actually have, you know, this is a little bit messy, but ultimately what I wanted to demonstrate is that we have a pretty simple description of what we have yet to fill. And then what happens is you start to use the horn filling condition on these mapping spaces. This is where the Kahn complexes being the mapping spaces comes in, becomes relevant. So there's an efficient way to organize how this works. So suppose you're given one of these unfilled simplices. And let's say it's non-degenerate, which here means that you never see two of the same set twice. You can look at the least index where the corresponding set does not contain K. You know there is some set which doesn't contain K. You let B be the least guy so that it does. And then you look at your tuple. So, you know, you've got S naught, maybe something else, maybe SB comes in, SB plus 1, and so forth. And you look at what happens just before SB. Now this guy, it might be equal to SB together with K. We know it contains K. Or might not be equal to it. So the point here somehow is that if this is not equal to SV union K, we can throw that guy in, and it will produce for us a new non-degenerate simplex with the one that we started with as a face. Conversely, if we remove this guy, we'll end up with something which is which doesn't have this as this term, because what we had here was non-degenerate. So what this construction somehow achieves is a bijection between unfilled simplices, so that everything is either the interior or the face of a horn. And then by a simple induction, you can just fill in these horns one by one. And in fact, when we do this, we're only using left horns, because this SB is always on the right someplace. Anyway, I won't bore you too much with this proof, but that's maybe a longer-winded proof of this result of Cordier and Porter than is necessary, but it's a useful proof. It's a proof that can be used to do more interesting things. So, well, anyway, this construction gives us some nice examples of quasi-categories. So, for example, the category of Kahn complexes itself is the quasi-category you could think of it as the quasi-category of spaces. We can take a particular simplicial enrichment of the quasi-category of quasi-categories, namely that enrichment where we take the maximal Kahn complex living in each of the Hom spaces themselves, which are quasi-categories. That gives us something enriched in Kahn complexes. And the nerve of this will give the quasi-category of quasi-categories. And there's a third example which I'd like to discuss, which is left fibrations over a simplicial set S. So a left fibration, just to recall, is a morphism of simplicial sets which has the right lifting property with respect to all horns like so, where 0 is less than or equal to K, is less than N. And between any two of these guys, if you look at the simplicial mapping space of maps between two such guys, which is strictly over S, so it's strictly compatible with the map over S, this is a Kahn complex. This is another consequence of Andre's theorem from 2002. So this guy is another example of a category enriched in Kahn complexes. And then we can take its associated quasi-category. And so we get somehow the quasi-category of left fibrations over S. Okay. And of course you can do other examples like this, but those are the three I'd like to talk about. So what I'd like to propose is a different approach to at least the first and the third of these two guys. And I guess I'll propose an approach to the second one, although, well, yeah. So we can write down a simplicial set, which I'm going to call, I'll do this one. I'm going to call this op fib over S for reasons that will become clear in a minute. S is, again, a simplicial set. The n simplices of these, of this guy, is going to be somehow the large set of left fibrations over delta n cross S. Okay? Now, this is not, strictly speaking, a simplicial set yet, because I'd like the boundary of degeneracy maps to be given by fiber product, and fiber product isn't given exactly. So you have to should specify more data there. But it's not too hard to do that. This is essentially the idea in any case. So this produces for you a simplicial set. And what's more that you can write down a map of simplicial sets, D, that runs from this guy, the nerve of the enriched category of left fibrations over S, to this up fib over S guy. Now, without... I skipped the board. Well, right. I skipped the board. Without going too much into detail of how this D is defined, I'll give you an idea of the flavor of it. So you want a picture of an n-simplex. So I'm going to draw an n-simplex of n of L of S as a bunch of space, well, a bunch of left fibrations, x0, x1, x2, and x3, say. And that what you want to do is sort of specify components of this. So let's draw say, maybe a 5 simplex in here. So this would be sort of, well, let's see how to put this. I'll draw the picture and then I'll explain what's going on. So maybe, and then, well, maybe it's a 4 simplex. It's a little bit easier to draw. Yeah. So here's the point. You want there to be vertices which can show up in any one of the xi's. Like the image sort of left fibration should be somehow an amalgamation of data that which sort of crosses all of the xi's. It should be sort of a simplex in the end, which sort of looks like, well, there's a simplex here, a simplex here, a simplex here, and then two simplices here. So this is what it should sort of look at the level of the left fibration. And the idea is somehow you take, let's say you've got your x naught, and then you can apply F01 to that X0. And then maybe you get X1 here. And you'd like to connect them. You'd like them to be connected by a homotopy, but they're not necessarily the same. And so you go on. Actually, I misdrew this. Should be like that. You go on. So this will be sort of, well, for instance, this is F02 applied to X0. This square here is F02 applied to X0. You've got F12 applied to X1, and then you've got new guys X2 and X3. And then forward. So basically, you just want to connect everything together by all of the homotopy information. You want it to sort of glue together. And that should be what a I guess that's a 4 simplex in the image of D looks like. It's F02 in this sense. So, right. Good question. Well, no, I mean, it is a good question, because if you look at C of 02, that's going to be a... that's not a square, that's an interval. And so you might ask, why is there extra stuff? Well, it turns out that it makes more sense to index things according to the xi's than to index it according to the capital, the lowercase xi's than the capital xi's. It makes more sense to sort of count along here. I'd like it to not work necessarily that way, but it seems to work this way. But the point is that there are multiple things that you want to map to, and you just sort of, to get there to be enough information and also to get the combinatorics to work out well, it works out better this way. I'm sorry, I can tell you more about it afterwards, but anyway, that's supposed to give the flavor of how this D is defined. Which, I guess, leads me to this next thing. No, it's not. yeah, I'll give a formal definition. Okay. Yeah, wait a second. The formal definition would be, I need to paste all the C's together. So I'm going to define this new guy, psi of n. And, you know, again, I'll do it with our simplices. So we've got another thing based on subsets, where each of the SIs is a subset of bracket n. SI contains n now. It does not necessarily contain 0. But instead of that, we have the minimum of S0 less than or equal to all the way up to the minimum of SR. So the idea is this guy admits a forgetful functor somehow to delta n, where you just take you just take one of these SIs to its minimum. And the fiber over J, so the fiber over J in delta N is just C of bracket J N. So that's how these things connect. And so this guy, for example, is a picture of C of 5, or like C of 5, 1, 2, 3, 4. Actually, C of 4. So how does the formal definition work? Well, if you're given a tuple, so it's going to be like xi with fij, well, we want to specify what its R simplices are. So the R simplices are consist of tuples phi, comma, alpha naught through alpha r, where phi goes from, think of the map of, let's see, should go from bracket R to, I'm missing something, okay. This is an N simplex. So bracket R to bracket N, and the alpha i's should go from c of I to x sub c of I, and then they satisfy a compatibility, which is, again, easy to write down. And it looks almost identical to the one I had for the the coherent nerve. So how should this look? Well, if you have C of I, you can sort of attach to it C of I bracket ij. Right. You can map this over to, let's say, X C of I cross, X phi of I, and then C bracket phi of I phi of J down to C of J over to X phi of J, and then this map down is just given by F phi of I phi of J, and this guy is sort of a union map. you can take a set in here and take the union with a set in here and you get something in here. So this is somehow alpha I cross, well, some sort of inclusion. C is C in some sense. And this is alpha J. So that's the formal definition of D. And you know, the reason I didn't want to go into it too much is that it's harder to swallow than the one that I just did. But the complexity level is basically the same. And to prove that this D of an n simplex in n of L sub s is actually an n simplex in op sub over s, which is to say it's a left fibration. That's the important part. Comes down to essentially the same argument. And I don't quite have time to explain how that works, but it is essentially the same argument as this guy. So if you do your bookkeeping properly, these things fit together pretty well. Okay. Right. So, maybe it's unfair to ask this, but do people have questions before I go on? Anything else? Okay. Nope. Okay. So, okay, so the theorem in progress / conjecture is op sub over S is a quasi-category and D is an equivalence. Quasi-categories. So D is a mess. And I understand this to be true, but the way I look at it is that it's a mess that's only reflecting the messiness that's inherent in the coherent nerve construction. So the upshot of this business is that if we want to look at the quasi-category of spaces or the quasi-category of left fibrations over a fixed simplicial set, it's enough to look at this quasi-category, which is describable in one line. That's sort of the main point I want to get to. And so let me talk a little bit about how this can be a useful way to think about things. Oh, and one other thing is that, maybe I'll just state this as a conjecture. One should be able to imitate the same construction, instead of with left fibrations, with op-Cartesian fibrations, and get a model for the quasi-category of quasi-categories, or more generally, the quasi-category of op-Cartesian fibrations over a given simplicial set. But I haven't checked the details that have to go into that, most of the new details. So I'll just not even write on the board. It's a conjecture. All right. So let's see. What was my application number one? Okay. So one thing, which is something we look at in algebraic geometry a lot, or use, rather, is descent, which you should think of as sheaf conditions appropriate to the infinity one categorial setting. So how does this usually work? Well, you start with a check nerve. So you've got a base site, say, and you have some object that you'd like to descend along, and you've got a check cover or a hypercover, say. So I'll just write this sort of in shorthand. You've got a simplicial object. So or maybe a semi-simplicial object. And, well, you look at the fibers, so you've got your fiber guy over it, and you look at these, you look at the fibers over each of these guys, so m q naught m to x, m to u1, m u2, m u3. And so the idea is somehow you're going to have maps between these fibers. And, you know, the picture continues. And that the homotopy limit of this diagram, sort of broken off here, if the limit, you know, if you put this here, there's a map from Mx into it. And the point would be that this that this map is an equivalence or a weak equivalence, depending on your language. Now, this is formally a really nice definition, but in practice, it turns out to be difficult to use. In practice, you'd like to use something a little bit more hands-on, sort of object theoretic in the fiber. So in Boleyn and Mumford, there's an efficient description of what this descent condition looks like. So let's say in the category setting, basically it says that if you have a descent datum. So what does that entail? You start with an object x over u naught. You can pull it back in two ways, and I'll denote that by an object x1 over u1 with two maps to x naught. You can pull it three ways back from u naught to u2, and those should be somehow compatible with one another. I'll represent that by a single object with three maps to x1. So descent on objects for a fibered category takes the form of, given this data, you can find an object with x negative 1 over capital X together with a map, making this whole diagram into the appropriate part of a functor from delta into your total guy. Delta op, I guess. So there's a clear way to extend this in the fibered quasi-category setting. You just sort of continue this object further. But if you imagine trying to do this with some sort of fiber functor, some functor which assigns to objects downstairs some kind of space up to some sort of coherence, the condition becomes much messier. Writing down what a descent datum is becomes much more difficult. So that's one place where this can be helpful. Okay, something a little more practical. So that's one thing, descent. Another thing is computation of limits. So one thing that's very convenient about this ob fib over s business, and actually, well, I'm going to start using fib over s, because these guys are right fibrations, which are the things that show up in algebraic geometry naturally. Anyway, so you look at right fibrations, fib over s. Now, if you write down what it means to have a functor from a simplicial set T into this quasi-category, this conjectural quasi-category, it's literally the same thing as having a right fibration over S cross T op. And that's simply how the thing was defined. If you have a map from a given simplicial set, that just means to every n simplex, you assign a right fibration over, it's actually delta n op cross s. But but then you paste those things back together and you get a total left vibration. So all told, you get a right vibration over S cross T up. So, yeah. So anyway, we can use this to get a handle on what limits exist. So here's a diagram. Diagram is just going to be some morphism from a simplicial set into, say, fib over S. Actually, for simplicity, let's say a quasi-category of spaces, fib over star. You'd like to see what the limit of this diagram is. Well, this morphism is the same thing as a left vibration or a right vibration over D op. And now we can do an immediate construction. We just look at maps from D up into Z, maps from D up into D up. Yes, global sections. Yeah, I'm doing it explicitly because this is how I think about it. But yeah, it's global sections, right. You take the fiber product, and that gives you a Kahn complex. What is this Kahn complex? It's the limit of the diagram. Now, we haven't really discussed what it means to have limits, a.k.a. homotopy limits, in a quasi-category. But modulo the fact that modulo the supposition that fib over star is a quasi-category, it's true that this is the limit of the diagram row. So, yes, that's right. So we get n's and co-n's this way as well. Tensors and cotensors. Oh, cotensors, this way. So it's indexed by an arbitrary simplicial set, so it's more than just limits. Okay, so that's another application of this formalism. It makes it, you can sort of organize these things easier. And so the last thing I wanted to mention is the Yonnet dilemma, one formulation of it. Now, one funny thing about doing the Yonnet dilemma in quasi-categories is that it seems like there's an easy version and a hard version. The easy version is where you sort of show full faithfulness for one or two objects, and the full version, which shows fully faithfulness of a sort of global functor, is the harder version. But let me give you a formulation of the harder version, which is also true. So given a quasi-category X, you can form a quasi-category Y sub X. The n simplices here will just be the 2n plus 1 simplices of X, which you can think of as sort of maybe like so. So this would be, so it would break into two halves, sort of this half and this half. This is a 3 simplex in Y sub X. And you should think of this as a bunch of maps. So you have this one morphism in X, this one morphism in X, this one morphism in X, and this one down here. And so this is supposed to act as a 3 simplex in a sort of total object that models how mapping spaces fit together. So this thing comes equipped with two forgetful functors. You can forget about this half, or you can forget about this half. If you forget about this half, well, if you index it the way that I index it, this is sort of going contravariantly. So you get a map to X op. If you forget the second, the far half from where I'm standing, it's a map to X. So there's a functor from this guy to X cross X op. And it's not hard to show that, but this is a proposition. It's not hard to show that this is a right fibration. But now, because we have a right vibration, this immediately defines for us a functor. So y sub x is an object in right vibrations over x cross x op, but this is the same thing as the simplicial mapping space from fib over x, from x into fib over x. So one can think of y sub x as a functor from x into right vibrations over x. And the theorem, and this is a theorem, is that y sub x is fully faithful. Where, of course, by fully faithful here, I mean that the maps on Hom spaces are homotopy equivalences. So it's not going to be essentially surjective for the same reason that this doesn't happen in sheaves, but the map is fully faithful. So, okay, so that's Yoneda lemma. And, right. Okay, so one last thing that I'd like to say before I finish is that another situation that comes up in moduli theory a lot, which this language of a quasi-category built out of vibrations, would make easier to state, is morphisms between stacks. So, just as a typical example, there are many examples like this, but let me just pull out one. If you have a quasi-category X, and let's say two objects, a morphism F from X to Y in X, then we can look at the slice category X over X and the slice category X over Y. These are both right vibrations over X. And we'd like to say there's a composition morphism from X over X to X over Y. We'd like to say there's some sort of morphism like this. And there is such. It's just we don't know which one. There's no canonical such. Mainly it's account of this sort of maximal weakness of a quasi-category. If you took, for example, a morphism G going from Z to X, try to compose it with F, well, you can do it in some way. But there are multiple such ways, even though they're sort of they're canonically equivalent to one another. There's no canonical choice of such a thing. So there's no way to take a map from Z to X and then immediately associate it to it a map from Z to Y. However, you can write down a right vibration over sort of a right vibration, I don't know what you call it, something like C of F, maybe. No, D of F, I should call it, I guess. Over X cross delta 1, which somehow witnesses this. So it'll be a right vibration such that every map obtained in this way can be recovered as a lift somehow, a lift of the implicit morphism, implicit in the equivalence that I stated and now erased, a lift of this guy to an actual map of fibered quasi-categories, like here. So just to sum up, this gives one resolution not just of the clivage problem in stacks, but also the problem of even writing down what A a stack is, B what a morphism of stacks is, and, you know, if we get more into this theory, what higher morphisms of stacks are, and so forth.